there is absolutely no reason to believe that somebody, because he is a Christian, must be a conservative or must be a socialist. It's perfectly possible to be a Christian and to be either of those. It's a different interpretation. And that's one of the reasons why civilized discourse between opponents is so important. Nobody is right all the time.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep principles of the people shaping our common life. Each episode, I speak to someone with some kind of public voice or platform and try and get a sense of their values, their moral intuitions, if you will, and the journey they have been on to land where they are today. I speak to people from a really wide range of political, metaphysical, and professional positions. And so if you keep listening, you will hear someone from outside your usual filter bubble. That is by design. I think it's good for our souls. It's good for us as citizens to seek to understand where people not like us are coming from. And I also think if we build the muscle a little bit, we'll find it is more interesting than just sticking with the voices that we already know. We are in a special series of the podcast themed around my book, Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. In each episode, I went looking for a guest to help me reflect on one of my chapters. And seven of the chapters are themed loosely around the seven deadly sins. In a sloth / acedia, I'm looking at attention and distraction. And in envy, I'm looking at status anxiety and belovedness. But in today's episode, we're talking about my final chapter, which I title The G-Bomb. And it's where I get to that very tender and tricky topic of God. And so I went looking for someone to discuss it with me. And that person is Peter Hitchens. Peter is a longtime columnist for The Mail on Sunday. And he's the author of many books, including The Abolition of Britain, The Broken Compass, The Cameron Delusion, and A Revolution Betrayed. Which gives you a sense of his usual default tone, calling out what he senses is wrong about society and politics. And he is also the author of The Rage Against God, which was partly a response to his brother, Christopher Hitchens, writing against religion as part of the new atheist movement. And I think it is a really interesting and unexpected book, and slightly different tonally from the others, probably because of its subject matter. So that's why I wanted to talk to him. We spoke about his time at boarding school, in the International Socialists, what he thinks columnists are for, and as you might expect, we spoke about the G-bomb. There are some reflections from me at the end, and I really hope you enjoy listening. Peter, we are going to kick off with a new question that I'm asking people that hopefully will allow us to grasp towards something, even if it's not your standard question you get asked every day, which is, what does fully aliveness mean to you?
Well, in my life, it's often associated with exhilaration and fear, two things which intensify life enormously and make you realize who and what you are more intensely than anything else.
Could you say more about where those things tend to show up?
Well, in my life, they've tended to show up in the mad foreign countries that I've visited quite a lot of, when you're far away from what is familiar and normal and more vulnerable to surprises and shocks, and also more on your own. Though generally these things have happened to me when I've been in company with valued friends.
Yeah. Are you talking about, you've written about being shot at, being caught up in riots, those kind of moments?
Yeah, that sort of thing, but not always. Sometimes it's purely joyous. The collapse of the communist regime in Prague on a couple of very cold winter's days in 1989 had something of that feeling. The exhilaration was so strong at the fall of something wicked.
Yeah.
And combine that with extreme cold. I'd actually bought some communist long johns to withstand the extreme cold, but it was still very cold.
Have you sought out those kind of experiences in your life to
no,
get that?
No, I know that they have. Looking, if you ask me that question, I'll tell you that is largely the truth. I mean, there are obviously many other areas in life where you get something comparable or similar, but those are the obvious ones.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to that. But I also want to ask you about your deep values. And the language that I am familiar with is these sacred values. They're really these deep things that if someone offered us money to compromise on, we'd feel disgusted. We'd feel like something had been transgressed. You can think about them as the things that we want to orient our lives, that we want to live by, even if, of course, we sometimes fail at that as very fallible humans. Do any values come to mind that you have tried to live by that might take that sacred place for you?
I don't try to live by values. I don't think that would describe the way I approach it at all. But I think I get angriest at attempts to pervert either truth or justice.
Could you say a bit more about what those two things mean to you?
Not really, no. They seem to me to be quite unmistakable when you meet them. And also it seems to me to be quite obvious whenever you encounter anybody who is trying to destroy or overcome them. It's not a problem. The problem is how and whether you resist.
Yes. Can you think of moments in your life, this is often how guests who are less clear on what those North Stars or compass points are for them, I often say, can you think of a time in your life where you felt the temptation to compromise something deep?
Several,
whether you did or
yes.
Didn't. Do you mind telling us a bit about
it? I mind a lot, yes.
Okay. Tell us about your childhood. What were the big ideas in the air?
There weren't any. My childhood was just a sort of blissful dream when I was allowed to get on with doing what I wanted for months on end. And I wasn't given any, until quite late on in life, I wasn't given any moral instruction of any real shape until I was about 7 or 8. Attempts must have been made, but they passed me by.
Am I imagining you kind of running wild in the woods?
Yeah, that sort of
climbing
thing.
Trees.
Yep, riding my bicycle over the South Downs on long afternoons, completely unsupervised, nothing. I had to carry 4 pennies in my proper pennies in my pocket so that I could ring my mother at some point and let her know roughly where I was and when I might be coming back. That was it.
It sounds wonderful.
It was, and it's extraordinary how quickly it's come to an end for the next generation of children.
Yes, I spoke to Jonathan Haidt for our last series, who's really arguing for this. We're overprotecting children in the real world and underprotecting them online. And it's really, I hope, shifting a generation of parenting to let children take risks again.
Yes, not so easy though.
No.
If you're the one who takes the risk and it goes wrong. That's the difficulty. That's the huge pressure on every parent. You think, all right, well, let's try it the other way. And then it goes wrong, it's your fault.
Yeah.
It can go wrong. And actually, people go on about how people are afraid of having their children abducted. And of course, the whole Myra Hindley thing, which happened during my childhood, changed a lot of attitudes toward that. But the chance of that happening to you is very slender. The real menace, as in so many other ways it is a menace, the real menace is motor traffic. And the way in which it simply isn't compatible with children.
Yeah. Yes, and knowing where the edges of that is, what's the, mm-hmm. I say someone, mother
we just,
of young
we
children.
Just didn't have it.
Yeah.
Cars came, and then there was a long gap before the next one came.
Yeah, more space. Well, kind of in the background of that, and maybe at becoming more clear as you went off to school, you've written about being sort of raised as a young English gentleman in an era where that was even passing away.
Well, nobody said that. That was just what was around me and what I absorbed.
Your father was a naval officer?
Yes, but by the time I was coming into consciousness, his time in the Navy was coming to an end. Mm. One of the first things I can remember is the word Suez being constantly on the radio, and of him one morning getting up and in full uniform, gold braid and the lot, getting up and getting a rusty old bicycle out of the garden shed and pumping up the tyres to ride to the nearest station because there was no petrol.
Right.
Because one of the effects of the Suez Crisis was there was actually petrol rationing, and naval officers don't ride bicycles. at least they didn't then.
Right.
But so that was all coming to an end. And it was, in fact, Suez which put an end to his life in the Navy, because after Suez, so many of the great institutions of Britain and the Empire were wound up or shrunk. Mm. And he was one of the victims of that.
Could you say a bit more about that? Because it was one of the things in Rage Against God that was new to me. You traced this kind of intellectual trajectory of this world that you were raised in that, you know, you said it was more like the 40s and 50s than the 50s and 60s that it actually was.
The 30s, really, I think. I think if I met somebody who was raised in the 1930s in the class of sort of naval officers' children, I would have more in common with him or her than with anybody who grew up even at the time that I did, who didn't do that. It was a very old-fashioned world.
Yes, and the sense that I had is of you being raised kind of almost this sense that the empire was still present, that British power in the world, that these institutions. And then Suez was this real turn.
Well, it wasn't that. It was just that people, it takes a long time for people to realize that things have gone, that institutions have lost their power, that that morals have lost their force, particularly if you continue to live close to those things as you previously did in physical circumstances where the outward signs of them are still present.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
And it was a sense of a loss of legitimacy of authority. Is that a fair summary?
Oh, there was definitely loss of authority. You could tell they no longer had confidence in themselves. I didn't know why it was. I'm naturally a nuisance. As a child, I was a nuisance, the kind of child that doesn't necessarily do what he's told when he's told to do it. And I found quite early on at school that if you pushed against authority, it gave in. Mm-hmm. In a way which I don't think it would have done 20 years before, or even 10 years before. And I think Suez was at the heart of that. They'd made such complete fools of themselves. They didn't really, and nobody from the vicar to the policeman really had, or the teacher, really had the authority they previously had. I say that now. I didn't realize that was what was going on at the time, but I did notice how easy it was to push. You know the Lenin maxim?
Which one?
It's take the bayonet, insert it. If you encounter mush, continue to push. If you encounter steel, try somewhere else.
There was a lot of mush around.
There was a lot of mush around, yes.
And you were raised, you talk about your family not being particularly church-going, not much Christianity at home, but really strongly at school.
Yeah, we would have, every morning, we would have quite a substantial number of prayers and always a couple of the more classic hymns. So that would be every morning. On Sunday, we'd have a full rig morning prayer out of the Book of Common Prayer.
Mm. And do you remember a time where it was, and this feels like very...
I should just add to that, by the way. I went to several schools. One of the schools I went to was a cathedral choir school. Mm. And so the intensity of the religious experience there was much, much stronger, although I wasn't in the choir.
Right.
I can't sing. Which is evident from a very early age, but we would go across. The cathedral was about 100 yards from the back gate of the school. We'd all go across for evensong every day. So that was an unusual experience for most people. I tend to think that the combination of the Royal Navy and the Church of England at that point, very powerful influences on me, and I just got them both for nothing at close quarters.
And how much, and this is, it feels like a... It's potentially straying into psychobabble here, but the sense I have is that for some people raised with a religious formation, whether it's through school or home, that for some people it's sort of background noise, and for some people they have a deep sense of God, of an interior kind of religious life themselves. Which category would have you put yourself into as a younger child?
I didn't like it much.
Hmm. So it wasn't a great loss when you decided that you were an atheist.
Well, it was a natural progression from where I'd been. That's to say, I had begun to doubt practically anything anybody had told me. I was the usual 12-year-old troublemaker who didn't take anything that he was told. And this is one of the things, quite obviously, if you were going to be that person, one of the things you were going to begin to turn against was going to be religion, because so much fuss was being made about it by your teachers. So you would.
Yes. And do you obviously probably weren't conscious of it at the time, but looking back, do you think of it as related to that loss of authority, that loss of legitimacy of the generation above? You've spoken about them as really defeated and not wanting to be like
them.
Not
really, no, I don't think so. I think I would have done that anyway.
Yeah. You famously invited an audience to burn a Bible.
A small audience.
Were they ticketed? Were they ticketed?
No. It was on a playing field. I think there was some stupid rugby game going on at the time, and I and my companions were bored with it. Mm. So I said, let's go and burn my Bible. And it wasn't a success.
Mm. They're not very burnable.
They're not.
You have to rip them up quite a lot, I think.
I think maybe, but I hadn't had any practice, so I was, no, I just, no, and so everybody drifted away.
Yes.
As an event, it was a flop.
Yes.
And in fact, that's probably why I remember it.
Yes.
The flops and embarrassing disasters in your life are the things which are carved deeper into your memory than anything else.
Yes. That shame acts as a kind of photographic developer on memory, doesn't it? It really stays. You went to lots of different schools, and there's a real thing at the moment about lots of people talking about boarding school experiences that were difficult. You've said you weren't really cut out for some of them. How would you describe that?
I quite liked the boarding school I went to when would I have been from the age of about 9 to the age of 13. It was in beautiful grounds with a river running through it. We were allowed to do pretty much what we wanted most of the time. There weren't too many silly rules, and actually the teaching was extremely good. I never held anything against that. What I wasn't really prepared for was at the age of 13 going on to a minor public school where I just continually thought, how have I come to be abandoned among these people? I had nothing in common with anybody there. And why do I have to sleep in the same room as them at night? Hmm. It's never appealed to me, this business of communal sleeping. And it appeals me less and less as I grew older. And also, I just didn't. My brother went to the same school and had, by his own account, a great time. It fitted him. He somehow got on with it, but not I. So we came to a mutual disagreement, and I left.
You left the same school that he was at?
He'd left it by then. He was older than me. I left, I think, the year after he had left. But that had nothing whatever to do with it.
No.
It was being caught trying to break into a government nuclear fallout shelter that brought things to a head. Though I was still rescuable had I wanted to stay and had they particularly wanted me to stay. But I think both of us realised that it wasn't a relationship that was made in heaven.
Okay, we're going to have to hear more about that. It sounds like... My guess is that your socialism was already beginning to be quite live by that point.
Well, yeah, leftism. Whether it actually had the coherence to be called socialism, I don't know, but a sort of general tiresome...
So it wasn't a random prank. It was politically motivated.
No, it was nuclear disarmament and the Vietnam War and all that stuff as well.
Who introduced you to it?
Oh, my brother. He came home in 1964. I can date this very easily because what had happened was that I don't think he'd been particularly political before. When he went off to this school, first of all, he came back. He was just like any other public school boy. But then the Christmas of 64, he came back infused with political fervor. He'd been the Labour candidate in the school election during the general election of October that year. And I think that had brought it to a head. And it seemed to give him a great deal of fun. And it also provided a sort of scaffolding on which you could build all kinds of other things. And it appealed to me, so I took it on.
Do you think you were looking for an ideology?
I wasn't looking for an ideology, but I was looking for a reason to do things. Yeah. I know it's not, I mean, you might say that's the same thing, but I don't think I was anything like... capable enough to require an actual ideology or worldview at that stage. That came later.
Yes. I ask because you've written, I think, quite persuasively about... Actually, it's very hard to function without a guiding set of ideas. And you'd received this... the sort of Britain of the early 20th century had a guiding set of ideas, at least on the last legs, and they were failing. And so the draw towards a way of explaining the world and giving you a role...
Yeah, I'm sure that was part of it. Yes, but no doubt I've said so, and it is. But I wouldn't. Ideology seems to be quite a grandiose word for what I was actually experiencing.
And paint me a picture of that season of your life. What were you up to? Who were you with?
Up to? Well, a lot of it I spent at school. Sitting in classrooms, so I fell into bad company at school, as some people do, and I didn't help. But basically, I was confined in this place until I was about 16.
And then released and part of International Socialism? Was that what the organization was called?
I joined the International Socialists in 1968. I don't think I should have done. I think they may have had a minimum age, which I evaded, but I joined in 68. But more than a year after I'd left school.
Yeah. And, you know, it's quite a common stage in a lot of people's life, this draw to socialism, this draw to the left. We're seeing it now with a whole generation coming through a kind of revival.
It's a cliche. It's when people ask me that, I say, what? I mean, it's so completely uninteresting that someone becomes left-wing when he's a teenager. Haven't you got anything else more important to ask about?
I would love to know what, in the most generous interpretation that you can, either of your former self or the generation drawn to it now, what are they seeing? What are they longing for when they get interested in Marxism or its affiliates?
Well, everybody who looks at the world with any care sees an enormous amount of injustice, of people who are living lives worse than the ones that you lead, particularly if you're middle class, and quite possibly worse than they need to be. And so you engage quite readily and quite reasonably in trying to think of ways of making that better. And if someone comes along and says to you, well, there are ideas by which these improvements could be made, which you might want to support, then it's appealing.
And
it's not complicated.
No. And help me understand the timeline here, because you had a loss of faith in that way of seeing that methodology for making the world a better place. But you were also becoming a journalist. Which happened first?
Oh, well, I wasn't anything remotely resembling a proper journalist, really, until... I mean, I put in my Who's Who entry that I did a stint on The Socialist Worker in 1972, partly to annoy my old comrades and partly because I absolutely refused to hide in anywhere my left-wing past.
Mm.
But it was just a summer job doing a few things, like the occasional feature. I remember having once going down to write about some milk strike in Merthyr Tydfil, but it wasn't proper journalism as I now see it. I became a full-time apprentice reporter in 1973.
Mm.
I started full-time work.
And as you were losing faith in the revolution, what drove that?
Oh, it was obviously it had no connection with reality. If you lived, I was at the university in York, which is one of the new plate glass universities of the late 60s, and I was there in the early 70s, and it was as if this spaceship had been lowered down from outer space.
I went there also. I know it well.
And it wasn't in 73. It was in 70. It was new, and even more cut off really from its surroundings. Yeah. And you could live a life entirely. If I've been back since, and what I tend to find when I go back is that I'm revisiting an earlier version of the modern world. All the sexual rules, the rules about drugs, about behavior, about dress and everything else, which have now become totally normal and unexceptional, were pioneered there. That's how people lived. When you then went, as I did, to work on the Swindon Evening Advertiser in a pretty prosaic and, restrained industrial town, it became quickly apparent that the ideas which seemed to make sense and in those circumstances didn't make sense. And also the other thing which didn't make sense was the Marxist makes enemies out of practically everybody. And I found that the people that I had to deal with as a reporter on the Swindon Evening Advertiser, the Tory councillors, the police officers, the vicars and all the rest of the people you constantly, they were not the bourgeois monsters that I'd been taught to believe, and it was just insupportable. Also, I was reading, as a lot of defectors from Marxism do, I was reading a lot of Arthur Koestler, and particularly a book of his not widely known called Arrival and Departure, but which explores the problem that an awful lot of world reformers really need to reform themselves. That they're not quite in touch with reality. And I remember we used to get people would write in to the Socialist Worker asking for more information. And as I was the representative of the organization in Swindon, if anybody from Swindon did this, it was passed on to me, and I would go out on Friday nights on my bicycle and visit them and see if they were good prospects. And one of them lived in a village outside Swindon. I remember it was a very wet, windy night, but I still went out to the wind and the rain, to this cottage. This very rangy, gaunt man and his wife, who was obviously terrified of him in this quite squalid cottage. And he talked, more or less like a lunatic. And I made some inquiries about he had previously been in touch with the organization in Bath, and they said that he actually had a firearm, and they'd had to lock him up in the cellar once. So it encouraged the idea in my mind that actually the far left was not just inapplicable practically, but also tended to attract people who were not really quite right in the mind.
You've written a little bit about a trip to Prague and various meetings.
Much later than that, yes.
Okay. Tell me about this theme of freedom, because at points in your writing, I can really hear that when you're attempting to be very generous to the analysis of the problems that the left come up with, it's the solutions that you disagree with, and it's because you feel like those solutions are not applicable without restrictions on freedom. Is that a fair summary?
Well, almost everything is going to restrict somebody's freedom. On this, as on so many things, Karl Marx was right. No man fights freedom. He fights most of freedom of others. It's a banality. Anybody who tries to make freedom into a principle, which I think some people do on the supposed right because they can't stomach Christianity, is embracing a nonsense. You can't advance the freedom of X without diminishing the freedom of Y. You never will be able to.
And it's,
government is about balancing these things. It's not about tearing along, making X wholly free and Y wholly restrained.
And you became a foreign correspondent with a particularly formative time in Moscow. Could you say a little bit more about how you think that time shaped you and shaped your thinking?
Well, it didn't shape me. I already knew what I needed to know. I'd long ago abandoned Marxism when I went to live in Moscow. I really knew how bad it was in theory. What I hadn't, and you couldn't have done without living there, what I hadn't grasped was how bad it was in practice. And there were aspects of it as well, which didn't fully take shape in my mind until I'd left. And when I came back here, I was actually abroad for about 5 years. I was in the Soviet Union for 2 and a bit years, and then there was a brief gap, and I did a lot of traveling, and then a couple of years in the United States. And it wasn't until I came back, in my experience, other people may find different, in my experience, working as a resident foreign correspondent is a bit like being an astronaut. You're weightless, you're outside all the normal rules of life. You live in different, the money is different, the language is different. The whole world that you knew and which gave you your signposts and warnings isn't there. You have to learn to live a completely different way. And it's extremely exhilarating, as I said, and also sometimes quite frightening. But it's coming back to Earth when you come back after more or less five years in these weird circumstances to an ordinary suburban commuting life of offices and all the rest is a very one of the most forceful moments of my life. That's over now. I'm back. I'm not weightless anymore. I'm out of orbit, and I won't probably be going back into it. And that caused me to think a great deal about my own country, which I'd left in one condition and come back to and found in another. And I would ceaselessly find small things, little inefficiencies, surlinesses, nastinesses, or indeed bits of legislation, which made me think, what does that remind me of? I can't think. Where have I come across this before? And after a while, it came to me that an awful lot of it reminded me of the Soviet Union.
What made you...
The thing most powerful was the growing disdain for the married family and for the freedom of women to bring up their own children, because in the Soviet Union it had been a state policy that the state was actually to some extent the main parent, and that the parents of children were compelled by the wage system to go out to work very early on and leave their children in state nurseries for a lot of the time, and the upbringing of the child was taken over by the state, which was the Communist Party. And I also discovered, I mentioned it in the book, and it remains very important to me, a small park in part of Moscow called Krasnaya Preznia, Red Preznia. And it was unusual. A lot of the statues you found were very monotonous. It was Lenin, 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 everywhere you went. Lenin here, Lenin there, Lenin, even Lenin in the backyard, Lenin on the... But on this occasion, it wasn't Lenin. It was a child. And I looked at the inscription. I hadn't really been aware of this before. I should have been, but I wasn't. The inscription, and it was to a child called Pavlik Morozov, which basically means Paul Frost, is the end. And he probably doesn't exist. There's now been a lot of research into him, but he was a national martyr of the Soviet Union. He'd denounced his own parents in some famine. And he denounced his own parents to the secret police, and had then been killed by his grandfather in revenge for this act of treachery. And so he became the national martyr. The Young Pioneers would be, there were quite a lot of memorials to him, and his pictures of him were put up in Young Pioneer assembly rooms. And they were taught to revere this ghastly traitor. And one of my translators and fixers who was supplied to me by the KGB, even she shuddered in horror at that aspect of her childhood when I discussed it with her. It was a hateful thing.
Yeah.
But it was true. It had actually happened, and that statue was there. Oddly enough, when they swept away all the Soviet statues when the thing finally collapsed in August 1991, The statue to Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the KGB, and a lot of the Lenins were put in a special park near the river a few years ago. Some of them were being a bit roughed up, but they were kept. I've never been able to find out what happened to the Morozov statue. I think they were so ashamed of it they just destroyed it. But maybe it'll turn up. If it turns up anywhere, I should be very worried. But the thing was that it wasn't just shortages and greyness and regimentation and secret police. It wasn't just a poorer, crummier, less free version of the West. It was actually wholly different. And it was this hatred of the married family and its privacy and freedom which was at the heart of that difference.
Yes, I can really hear that really troubling undermining of these loyalties that come naturally to us in favor of loyalty to the state.
Well, Orwell is very good about it in 1984, that the children all belong to this organization literally called the spies, and they denounce their parents, the secret police, and rejoice as they're carted off.
There's
not much further down the road.
No. How rapid was this sense of, actually, I understand this world, I would call myself a socialist, a losing faith? Did you very quickly come to the conclusion, actually, what I am is a conservative?
No,
or was there a long period of not really having a home?
No. I stopped being a Trotskyist. I actually wrote a letter of resignation to the organization sometime in 1975, which, idiotically, I didn't keep a copy of. And I can't find the person. I know the name of the person I sent it to as well, but I can't find her. And I had relied very heavily on MI5 having kept a copy. But they seem to have destroyed my file, so... It doesn't, but I quit them in 75. But I didn't then cease to be a socialist. The Kerstler Bridge carried huge numbers of people out of Bolshevism into social democracy, which to some extent is where I still am.
Yes, you. I'm always fascinated by the way this language is slippery, and when we use phrases like liberal or conservative, we have such different associations with them. So I'd love, if you don't mind, to just say kind of, what are your deep political principles? Whatever label they end up, whatever box they end up in.
The principles, they're just practical desires. I think that it's necessary particularly in an advanced and wealthy society for the state to intervene sometime.
Mm-hmm.
The principle is ceded by the most, all but the most completely barking libertarians. Whenever people say, what about nationalisation and states running? I say, well, do you think that Royal Navy should be run as a private concern? And of course they don't. There are some who do. There are some who think it should be contracted out to privateers, but I think we can reasonably lay them aside as serious players in the political battle. There are things which the state does better. And that's one of them. Railways is another, in my view. But there's no great sort of hierarchian moral force. It's just don't dare nationalize anything.
Yeah.
I'll nationalize some things and not nationalize others. It's wholly pragmatic to me because I do think that a lot of people are weak and damaged and afraid, and they need some help. And an organized state under law is quite a good way of providing it to them.
But with the language of social conservatism, a sense of actually individual moral choices are not the highest good, that there are other things at play?
The highest good? I'm not sorry, I don't have a highest good in politics. The highest good is in eternity. You mustn't mix up the two. And Quentin Ho is very good about this. There is absolutely no reason to believe that somebody, because he is a Christian, must be a conservative or must be a socialist.
Yeah,
it's perfectly possible to be a Christian and to be either of those. It's a different interpretation.
Yeah,
and that's one of the reasons why civilized discourse between opponents is so important. Nobody is right all the time.
Yes, I often ask guests, because I interview people from radically different principles, perspectives, religious positions, and I often ask them, what is the one thing you wish people understood, but they don't seem to? You said to me on Twitter that you're constantly trying to explain to people why you hold views they don't expect you to hold.
I don't think I can narrow it down to one thing. I'm afraid there are so many.
Okay,
and
so
people don't. The main thing people have to understand is that almost certainly the opinions they hold are not their own opinions. The great Jonathan Swift's law, you cannot reason a man out of a position he wasn't reasoned into in the first place. I know this.
Yeah.
I've tried. You can't do it. And not many people have.
How do you think people come to their opinions?
They pick them up. Less and less from their parents, more and more from, certainly in the years when I was growing up, from television. It's the national sense of humour, which is now almost completely uniform, was provided by television, as far as I can see.
Right.
I don't actually find a lot of it particularly funny, but they do, and there you are. It's been a hugely conformist force in all the opinions that people hold about practically anything.
Mm. And
that's just now moved on to antisocial media.
Yeah, good phrase. One of the places people get their opinions from is columnists. Do you see that?
No, they don't.
Okay.
They go to columnists for reassurance about the opinions they already hold.
Right.
I think there are very few people who go to columnists to try and learn from somebody who disagrees with them. I just don't think that's what I do as a columnist. It's when I'm on Twitter that I tend to be engaging with people who don't agree with me, and generally who haven't read a word that I've said or listened to anything that I've said either.
Yes.
They just hate me.
So what do you think a good columnist is doing? What role do they play in the public conversation?
There's a lot of it is, as I say, the reassurance and encouragement of people who hold the same position as you do. And that ultimately, during the Great Panic, that was the main thing that I did. And people still come up to me in the street. And it's quite moving because they say, I thought I was completely around the bend, and it was really important to me that somebody in national media was saying what he was saying.
Mm.
And the reassurance and the encouragement that you're not alone.
Yes. Do you... This may be too private, so say. I'm sure you will. I find the concept of vocation very helpful. The idea that whatever work we're doing in the world, it's meaningful, it has impacts on other people, it helps create the moral environments in which we all swim. Do you see what you're doing as vocational and morally weighty or not?
I think I'd have to ask other people to judge whether it was morally weighty. I would like it to be, but it probably very often isn't. But I'm not the judge.
Yes.
Anything. You should never be the judge of practically anything you've done because your memory will lie.
Yes.
You'll exaggerate the wrong things and minimize the others. And you will be, and this is, I learned this the other day, I don't read Kierkegaard because it's too complicated for me, but sometimes I learn things that he said. He said that we are objective about other people and subjective about ourselves, and we should do the opposite.
Yes.
But we don't.
No, never.
Well, no, you can. You can, for a few brief moments, force yourself to be objective about yourself, but not for long, because it really isn't much fun.
No, I mean, confession helps, as you said. I think I'm asking because whenever I'm approaching a new interviewee, I kind of have the sort of public persona of them, right? And then you get to know the complexities. And whenever I'm approaching a columnist, the more complexities that you get in books than in columns. And whenever I'm approaching a columnist, because mainly what I know of them is from their columns or their, you know, short debates on the radio, I always assume that they will be very sure of themselves and very confident in their own opinions and have very little self-doubt. And actually, particularly in this book, Rage Against God, there is a very startling humility in your tone and a very harsh sense of your own character and virtue.
Well, I was writing a book about God. I mean, and about people's attitude towards it. I can't. It'd be ridiculous, wouldn't it, not to at least make some effort to take a jaundiced look at yourself. But don't worry, I keep a lot of it secret.
Good. But I'm trying to tease out how this plays out in your writing a column. Because if you are someone who has and says every Christian should have a low opinion of their own virtue, and you are someone who has publicly changed their mind in a way that is quite unusual and refreshing. Do you ever agonize over a column? Do you ever write it and think, what if this has a terrible impact in the world? What if I'm wrong?
No, that wouldn't be what I write a column and throw the whole thing away because I can't stand it on rereading. Start again.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I can't think how I would, by anything that I write, risk setting anybody on a wrong path. Mm. People don't come to me for advice about their personal lives.
Yes, you're not a priest after all.
And I don't think that they would be wise to do so.
So we've kind of traced your loss of faith in socialism and then a period that you talked about as being...
I didn't have faith in socialism. I just didn't... I found it didn't... The particular form of Marxist-Leninist politics, which I had embraced, didn't no longer made sense. It wasn't. Yeah. It seemed to me to be impractical and narrow.
Yeah, rejection of it.
Well, it was just... It didn't conform with reality. You could only sustain it in the bell jar of the university campus. It couldn't exist, and I was very lucky to be chucked into a place so unlike that immediately after I left.
Yes. And then this period of, you've talked about sort of mainly being about pleasure and ambition, a sort of dawning sense of conservatism, and somewhere in there, a return to church, a return to a sense of the sacred.
Well, yes, but it's my return to religion is a cliche. Again, it's like being a youthful revolutionary. The young man has children, gets married, earns a living, and starts to see the world differently. Tell me something new.
I don't think I believe in people's lives ever being a cliche.
Peter. Well, the thing is that the bits of my life which aren't a cliche are private. I'm not going to talk about them. So,
well, there's a few things that you have written about.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'd love to hear about the role of fear, because you spoke about fear and exhilaration early on as about fully aliveness. And this part of your slow return, which you've rightly said is, and I really respect, it's more private than asking about someone's sex life. This deep, intimate encounter with the divine is not something to be trespassed upon.
Well, I don't have any visions or swoons or.
But things of that kind. You saw a painting of the Last Judgment.
I did see that painting. Yes, and what did you then say?
Could you tell us about that moment?
Well, it wasn't a moment. I'd had lunch, quite a vinous lunch in Beaune, which, if you haven't been to it, you should go to. It's lovely, lovely French town, the centre of the Burgundy vineyards, and. What I like doing most on holiday is having nice lunches and then going on to look at great works of art. And the great work of art in the Hotel Dieu in Bern is The Last Judgment, painted by Roger van der Weyden, one of the Flemish masters. And I went along to see it in the spirit of artistic interest, because he was obviously a great painter. thinking, oh, not another last judgment, because I have seen, as anybody who's been in the great galleries of Europe, a lot of last judgments. But this particular one was different, because scampering about at the bottom of the picture, heading towards the pit of the damned, were quite a lot of actually naked people.
Mm.
And they looked very much, one of them looked quite like me. And others looked very much like the kind of people I lived and moved and had my being with. They did, because they were not clothed or otherwise different, as I think I say in the book, trapped under thick layers of time. They were people as I might have known them. And I thought, what if the idea of the Last Judgment isn't a medieval fantasy, and that it is actually a real thing that applies in the modern world? You don't see many modern Last Judgments, do you?
No.
You don't. In fact, they're quite unpopular, even in the church. Did you know York Minster has some of the best glass in England? It's almost an English Chartres, but there's a whole row of windows, some of the older windows, which are up at about the height of about 30, 35 feet.
Mm.
They're very hard to see. And these are pictures of, these are Last Judgment, Hell and Damnation pictures, windows, which were moved there, not in the 20th century, but in the Middle Ages, because people didn't like them much.
Yes. Yes, it...
It's the thing. Once the idea has taken root, maybe this thing is actually real, then I think it's worth considering.
I spend a lot of time on this section when you write about it, because you say something very beautiful. You say, maybe I should be ashamed to admit that fear played a role in this return or rediscovery, but the sense of your own sin, your sense of your own desire to avoid judgment, was a real thing to you. And you rarely hear people saying that, actually quite raw, expressing such a raw human thing.
Well, there you are. I mean, what can I say? It's there it is. That's what it was. But it was long after that I returned to the church. It wasn't some great.
You can fall on your knees and accept
moment.
Jesus as your Lord and Savior.
I did not fall on my knees, no. I continued my tour of the vineyards of Burgundy. Very nice they are too.
Yes.
Another of the works of God in some ways.
Yes.
The making of wine, but there you are.
I think the dots I'm trying to join is that you said at the beginning about coming to the conclusion that lots of people who are trying to reform the world should instead be reforming themselves.
Oh, completely. But that starts with me.
Yes. And also now when you write, you're often talking about sort of grand utopian social justice projects as of less importance or less interest or even dangerous compared to this kind of minute, practical, everyday focus on our own character.
They're two different things. Okay. The problem with the revolutionary worldview and its allies, and there are many revolutionary worldviews which don't actually involve anyone climbing onto barricades in one of those French paintings with bayonets and women with their breasts showing. You don't need to have all that to have a revolution. A revolution can be conducted by changing the way that things are taught in schools or who runs the television studio. Those are the revolutions. Anybody who wants to revolutionize society has almost certainly gone beyond the limits of where they should be going.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing is they're attempting to alter the lives of other people to conform with what they want.
Yeah.
Because they think that those people would benefit from the disciplines which they want to impose on them. And ultimately this leads to all kinds of horrible things. Don't do that would be my profound lesson. It will never end well. But it's separate from the question of whether you can make society better in your own lifetime by practical actions and intelligent policies. Or, much more important than the current world, whether you can stop it getting any worse by preventing people from making it worse.
Yes.
My current preoccupation.
Is it fair to say that an awareness of sin or our human failings came before wanting to talk about God in the way that you do in this book?
I never wanted to talk about God.
No, it's a very hard thing to do well.
I don't want to do it. That book was wrung out of me. I didn't want to write it.
I'm sorry to be digging it up for you today.
No, I did. Although I didn't want to do it, I did do it. It is published under my name. I must take responsibility for it.
So it
But it wasn't. It was somebody else's idea.
It surprised me in lots of ways because of the kind of, you know, the two-dimensional portrait I had was of, you know, Christopher Hitchens, your brother, new atheist, banging away at that cause. And then you on the other side, you know, the title even, you know, just like going toe-to-toe on the intellectual arguments for and against God. Your first chapter is instead very much, much closer to the chapter I have written on God in the book I have out, which, you know, given our different tone and positioning, I wouldn't necessarily have expected, which is, talking about God is much more fruitful in poetry than prose. This is not something you're going to argue someone into. And you talked about it being something that we choose to believe and about the desire for there to be a God. Could you just say a little bit more about that position? Because it was really striking to me.
Oh, well, I don't see how you can avoid it. It is the existence of God is unknowable. Therefore, it cannot be, you can't attain an opinion on it through research or through knowledge. So there is only one way in which you can reach an opinion on it, and that is through choice. And choice is almost always driven by desire. It's not a complicated thing. Mm. I find that atheists object very strongly, with the exception of Thomas Nagel, whom I mentioned, to this formula, because they know perfectly well what I'm saying about them.
Mm.
And why would you want the universe to be a vast cosmic car crash with no reason for existing and no purpose for continuing to exist, in which everything you do is judged only by its immediate observable consequences? Why would you want that?
Mm.
It doesn't take much intellectual candle power to work out what I'm saying about atheists, does it? So they object very so. They also, no, I couldn't believe. I have no belief. And they try and attribute their unbelief to some external force. And I find, well, mollusks may have no belief and bricks may have no belief, but there's no human being who hasn't at some point or other considered the origins of the cosmos. They've considered it. They've decided they don't want it to be designed or created.
Yes, you quote Somerset Maugham early on in that season where you're a kind of rebellious teenage atheist of wanting there not to be a God because
it liberated him. Liberated him. He was fantastic. That the book of Human Bondage is extraordinarily frank about that.
Yeah,
Maugham had many drawbacks, but he also had many strong qualities, and one of them was a severe honesty, I think, about himself.
Yeah,
and that plainly. Of Human Bondage is plainly autobiographical, and that moment which he describes plainly happened to him.
Yes. And I guess I'm wondering then, having had a season of presumably not wanting to be there to be a God, what changed and made you do want, that's a terrible, terrible sentence, what changed to make you desire there to be a God?
As I say, you can't, you find there are other things in life than your own immediate pleasure and satisfaction and ambition.
Mm.
But as I say, I cannot, will not go into the personal details of that.
No.
Even if I wanted to, it would also involve talking about other people who have no business talking about.
Yes, yes. The theme that comes through a lot is this, and I think you even say it explicitly: this longing for the audience, this longing for the universe to have justice in it.
Well, the thing is, there cannot be anybody who sought justice in any small or large thing in life discovers very rapidly there isn't much of it about.
Yes.
Generally, you don't get it.
Yes.
If you do, it takes years, and it's unsatisfactory when it arrives. But on the other hand, we all appear to be, it's almost as big a mystery as conscience. We all appear to be equipped with a raging desire for it.
Mm.
So I don't think, one of the most powerful arguments for, particularly for eternal life, is that justice, which we desire, is obviously impossible in temporal life. So it can only be attainable in eternity. Therefore, if we desire justice, we must seek the eternal and hope for it and believe in it.
Yes. It's not just...
That's a very simple logical statement to me. I don't know whether it strikes you as complex, but it seems to me, if justice is what you want, as I say, as the mystery of conscience is, it's always seemed to me to be a very great challenge to the atheist, but the mystery of the desire for justice is another.
Yeah, so it's the C.S. Lewis thing, isn't it? If you discover in yourself a hunger that cannot be met by worldly things, does it give you a clue that there's something beyond? Yes. Justice and order as a...
I don't say much about order.
Well, you say it in here. And it
I say no, order of the proper sort follows from self-government.
Say more. If you're willing.
Well, I think it's if I had a utopia, which I'm not allowed to have because I'm utopia is a blasphemy, it would be a society governed by conscience. Mm. But what you could certainly have a society more governed by conscience than the one we have now.
Yes.
I know that because I lived in one. The one I grew up in was far more governed by conscience than the one we have now.
Yes. And it's striking when you talk about what you love about the church and what you miss about the church that was, is this focus on confession and atonement and the continual taking account of our own soul and our own sins as presumably a way of staying in touch with our conscience? Is that fair?
Yes, sure, yes. And of making it plain that we are not, that we are fallen beings and that we cannot attain anything remotely resembling goodness on our own. Yeah. But the opening of every, the principal service of the Church of England until the end of my childhood was morning prayer. And it opens with a very severe confession, which everybody has to say out loud.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you'll find that where the modern services, where they have confessions at all, they're so bowdlerized and diluted that they are a wholly different thing.
I want to end by asking, so the phrase I would naturally use is about the spiritual landscape. But when you were writing this book, I know, I thought it might not be to your taste. This book, you are arguing really against the New Atheists, which were very live at the time, and tracing this kind of 20th century, you know, you talk about the generation that were too clever to believe in God and the role of sewers and this kind of what led to the great decline in church going, the kind of history of ideas. I think we're in a very different place now. What we're not seeing is any indication that church going is spiking. I wonder if there is a new interest amongst some groups in maybe religion has something to offer us, you know, shock horror. But where do you think we are now? When you try and talk about God or church in public, how much do you think the atmosphere has changed?
Oh, it's easy for me. But you see, it was always easy for me to be, as a combative person, to be defending a religion against its enemies than to actually making out the case for religion itself.
Hmm.
And that was a great boon to me. It was that I'm much more comfortable doing that. I don't think it's changed all that much. I think for most people, there's vast grey indifference and ignorance.
Hmm.
Nobody's taught anything about it. They come out of school, they come out of school knowing more about the Greek or the Norse myths than they do about the Bible now.
Mm.
And it's the language isn't known. I said in the way that people of my generation would say about, I won't give you the context. I said the other day to somebody in Oxford, he was an Oxford undergraduate. I said, well, I suppose he's his sort of John the Baptist then. And he looked at me. He couldn't quite bring himself to say who's John the Baptist, but that's what he was thinking.
Yes.
Now, where do you begin?
Yes.
The problem with Christianity is that it really has to be apprehended as a child. It's very difficult for adults because it's quite a complicated set of propositions, actually. And also it requires a fair amount of reading, which people don't do much these days.
Yes.
And there's a lot of... I'll get into trouble here, but who cares? There's a lot of this happy clappy stuff, which doesn't seem to me really to do the job.
I hesitate to tell you that that is exactly where I would sit.
Happy clappy.
All kinds. I am a big fan of morning prayer and
sad clappy.
Sad clappy. Yeah, I have a good weep quite often lying on the floor,
rolling about.
Rolling about.
Having a nice trance.
Yeah.
Speaking in tongues?
Speaking in tongues.
Mm, okay, well, shucking it.
Please go ahead. We could pray together now if you'd like.
No.
There are many more things I could talk to you about, but I'm very grateful for your time today. Thank you for speaking to me on The Sacred. Well, as those of you who are in the UK and had heard of Peter Hitchens might guess, I went into that interview not entirely sure how it would go. He is well known as being someone with very strong opinions that he defends robustly in public. And we're just very different in terms of posture, approach, temperament, which is not uncommon for me and is very baked into this project. One of the things I love about it is getting to seek to understand someone who's coming from a slightly different place. And I don't necessarily find it worrying or threatening. But because he has this reputation of, I think, sort of, whether you say it affectionately or otherwise, as a curmudgeon, I didn't know how the interview would go. You know, sometimes those kind of conversations can be really fun, and sometimes they can just be difficult to get a real connection going. And there'd been a bit of a kerfuffle in the last few months with an interview he'd done with someone else. And so I went into it thinking, okay, I wonder how this will go. I had been really intrigued by what I'd read of his writing and as I was seeking to understand him. And I did feel like, you know, for all his sort of stylistic quirks, I really did get a sense of him as a man and what drives some of the positions that he's arrived at. And I think that sense of his childhood is really key. You know, the being raised in an era that still felt like it was very orderly. You know, it was very authoritative. He's talked about growing up in the 50s and 60s, but feeling like it was the 30s and 40s. He was the son of a naval officer. You know, he was sent to boarding school. The sense of the empire actually still in the background. And then in these formative years in his childhood, the Suez Crisis, which I hadn't really understood as how kind of tectonic it was in a cultural shift, really revealing a lot of that to be a sham or kind of already undermined, this sense that the world he was being raised in was no longer authoritative. There was, you know, I think it's a phrase from Marx actually that's coming to mind, all that is solid melts into air. And the kind of destabilizing effect of that. And he loops back to it when he's writing about God in his book, in terms of one of the things that draw him is someone who longs for the world to be orderly, for there to be justice, for there to be, I don't know if he longs for there to be hierarchy and authority, maybe not, but certainly order and justice. So understanding that really helped me. And yeah, that phrase about, a really brutal phrase about, you know, it's the old Leninist, I think, phrase, you know, if you put the bayonet in and you find mush, you keep pushing. Really gross as an understanding. And helping me understand that is really key to his temperament. And I think probably quite a lot of people's temperaments and their intuitions and their longing about the world. If we think back to Jonathan Haidt, who I talked about The Anxious Generation with, and his seminal work about moral taste buds, about this sense that actually what differentiates often people who have kind of progressive intuitions or left-wing intuitions from those who have right-wing intuitions is this sense of seeking order, of seeking, of having a wider range of moral taste buds than the left, which tend to just focus on kind of fairness and equality. And it's not, I don't know where I sit politically. I'm deeply confused on many things, having listened to too many different voices for too long. But I don't have such a strong intuition. The longing in me is not, maybe it is for justice, not so much for order. It's more for a loving gaze. That's what, you know, because Peter and I agree, we're Christians. We have the same, landed roughly in the same place, but he's landed there via a very different path for, I think, very different reasons. And I don't think I'm putting words in his mouth. I think I'm trying to accurately represent how he narrates himself. And it sounds like it wasn't a loss of personal faith, that he didn't really have a sense of kind of God in his world before this outburst of teenage atheism. Even though he was from a very Christian world, you know, at his boarding school. And that, you know, having burnt his Bible in this very dramatic moment, being part then really in a very significant way, and he went on to at York University, he was going out and organising miners and organising people in the dockyards, you know, really working closely with workers to organise them. that that purpose and story really was a home for him for a while, and very convincing. And I think when I asked him to say what is the most generous interpretation of why that political thread pulls so many people, and particularly so many young people, he gave quite an honest and, I thought, fair response, which was they see the injustice of the world. You know, it's not fair. The world's not fair. And trying to find a response to that, a story that makes sense of that, I think is key for a lot of us. And again, I see this in his writing. And again, I think it's probably more in The Rage Against God than elsewhere. But he comes up with these very belligerent, maybe that's unfair, these very certain statements. And then there'll be this switch where he acknowledges what he thinks is good in the other side or what deserves sympathy, in a way that's quite refreshing. And the story that he tells about losing faith in Marxism is a classic example of contact theory. It is a, it's sort of complete common sense, but there is a lot of evidence in the kind of peace-building reconciliation world and in this, I've forgotten the policy phrase for it, social cohesion world, that basically it's really hard to hate other people and believe stereotypes about them until we come into contact with them. And so one of the ways you build a peaceful society is you create lots of situations where we have to come into contact with each other. It's why schools are useful. It's why unions used to be really good for that. It's why kind of architecture that helps us actually know our neighbours. It's why going to physical shops, not just buying all these things online. Really important for healthy societies. John Yates calls it a common life, these set of institutions that hold us together and force us into contact with each other. Because Peter thought, you know, All these people were bourgeois monsters. And then he met them and quickly realised that they weren't. And this worldview that had made a lot of sense at university no longer made sense to him. And yeah, and again, the piece of the puzzle about his time in Russia, why he's so virulently opposed to left-wing ideas or progressive ideas, having seen what I think... not everyone would agree with this, but he would narrate as the sort of logical endpoint of some of those ideas in Stalinist Soviet Russia as very formative, and particularly this thing about the family, the undermining of family ties by authoritarian regimes, by that Soviet regime, the turning of child against parents and the restriction of the parents' ability to raise their own children. It's a really strong thread in his writing. And one of the things people really fear, I think, about some leftist, liberal, progressive models of the state as having a bit more involvement in children's lives than someone like Peter would certainly be comfortable with. That felt like a key piece of the puzzle. Columnists are there to reassure people of their opinions. I mean, yes, that is functionally how they work, obviously. And I felt that, you know, you really want to read someone smart say something that you already thought. And then you get this little release of sort of reward hormone. This like, oh, yes, I was right all along. There is a reward pathway in us that wants to be reaffirmed and reassured in their opinion. Sometimes people write to me and say, I love this podcast because you say things that I agree with. And I'm like, great. Please keep listening. That's you. But also... there is another reward pathway that reacts with surprise when we have a pre-existing assumption of something about something and then we're wrong, but we're wrong in a way that's kind of kind enough or gentle enough or has enough connection with us to take us with it rather than us just reacting against it. And I think a lot, now I read columnists I disagree with. Maybe I'm just a weirdo, but I do go looking for columnists who will make me feel great because they agree with me, but I also go looking, I'm looking for a mind at work, which is why I'll read someone like Peter. There's a few people on each of the papers that I know aren't just going to trot out the same thing every week, that I can see them sort of thinking and changing their mind and landing on different positions. But I think he's right. Generally, we read columnists to be reassured in our own positions, and that is both okay, but definitely has limitations for how it forms us and our ability to listen to people different from ourselves. I won't go on this rant, but I don't believe any life is a cliche. I think that like, oh, it's just a cliche. Stop being a cliche thing is really damaging and dangerous because we are, in my understanding, relational people made in the image of a Trinitarian God. But you could just say hypersocial people, sociologically. We're collective. We are informed by other people. Of course we do things in a similar order as other people. Of course we have similar longings. Of course we tried things and the same way as other people do, and shouldn't be ashamed of it. This sense that we need to be this wild original that is hacking our way through life as this rugged individual, it's just nonsense. All of the good things in life, we will not have been the first person to come up with them, and they are often old and true and vital, and we just need to not be obsessed with originality and be prepared to be a cliche. That's my sermon. Desire and choice. Yeah, again, this is one of the things that Peter really surprised me with. He doesn't try and get into an intellectual ding-dong with his brother. And the beginning and end of that book is very tender about their brotherly relationship, actually. Clearly was not easy at any point. But right at the end of the book, he gestures towards this longing for reconciliation in a way that you're not quite sure if it was too late or not. But he says, you know, to believe in God, you have to want there to be a God, and you have to choose, and you have to open yourself, and you have to move towards it. And that's a precondition. And very few people will be argued into it. They have to choose to walk. You know, they have to ask and seek and knock and those kind of things. It's not a provable thing. And I don't think that many people... I just think we've got this really strange understanding of how we make those big decisions, and it's not arguments and evidence, it's relationships, encounter, desire, longing. And then where we really differ is about fear and sin. And again, I think a lot of this is temperamental. I'm not a Christian because I fear judgment. Maybe I should have a heavier understanding of my own sin. But I think it's partly generational. You know, there's not that many people for whom carry a load of guilt about their own sin. We might carry shame about our identity. But he talks about fear being a very powerful driver for his conversion. This seeing the last judgment and thinking, I have fallen short, I have failed. And again, that comes up in his writing, probably not in his column. But this is, he has a very low estimation of his own moral virtue. I tried to get that a little bit about how that shows up in the column, because I think when you are kind of offering other people opinions, there is a sort of responsibility there. But in terms of what he is looking for, therefore, in his religious practice, he really likes confession. He really likes absolution. He really likes those containers. And I do too, actually, in this, you know, I'm sort of much, there's lots of ways we'd be very different. But I do think any practices, habits, and rituals that make it difficult for us to locate evil outside of ourselves, that stop us focusing on how everyone else gets everything wrong. And in some ways, you know, I do think that it is possible to try and reform the world. I don't think we should give up on that project in the same way that Peter does. But the project of reforming ourselves, paying attention to our own heart and soul and our own dishonesty and selfishness and disconnection is important. And being part of communities that will remind us of that, that will call us to a rigorous understanding of our own failures and the way we harm each other. I would want to approach that with some self-compassion and, yes, some understanding of the drivers, but ultimately wishing away the ways we harm each other and sort of pretending that no one is responsible for anything doesn't actually seem as liberatory as it promises to be to me. I wish I said that really funny minute. Oh, I would have loved to have prayed in tongues with Peter Hitchens. Maybe if I go to one of his Book of Common Prayer services, he would come to a happy clappy service with me, and we'd see where that led. But yeah, very interesting, you know, slightly awkward at times. Lots to think about. Thank you so much for listening to me on The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos. Our production team are Fiona Hanscom, Dan Turner, and Amari Gandrin. You can find us on all the socials. You can write to me via my website, elizabetholdfield.com, and I have a Substack, morefullyalive.substack.com. I really hope you'll be in touch. Until next time.